Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
This is Discovery from the BBC. I'm Jamal Khalili, and today I'm talking to one of the world's leading researchers about their life scientific. My guest today is a world authority in the field of artificial intelligence. But it wasn't a fascination with robots or complicated computer software that drew her to the field of AI. Rather, it was the deeper philosophical questions about the nature of the human mind and how computers could help with the answers that have obsessed her for more than half a century. Maggie Bowden is Professor of Cognitive Science at the University of Sussex, and her long career could be described as the very epitome of cross-disciplinary research. The profound questions she spent her life pursuing, the human mind, how our brains work and how they evolved, could never be neatly wrapped up within just one academic subject. So Maggie has spent decades straddling multiple disciplines, from medicine and psychology to cognitive and computer science, technology, and, of course, philosophy. She's researched and written authoritatively on all these fields, and along the way helped create entirely new academic disciplines. Maggie Bowden, welcome to the Life Scientific.
Thank you, Jim.
Can you tell me when it all first started, this fascination with the really big philosophical questions?
Well, my fascination with those questions began when I was, I don't know, maybe 13, 14. I mean, I was certainly still at school and not yet in the sixth form. And I was fascinated on the one hand by religion and the philosophy of religion and all those questions, which I think many, many people are. But I was also fascinated by evolution and in particular by the mind and how it works and how it's possible for the brain, you know, which is a material thing, to in some sense be responsible for our psychological being. And that always absolutely fascinated me.
And where did you go to satisfy this curiosity about these big questions?
Well, funnily enough, the Charing Cross Road. I remember going into the second-hand stacks and sitting on the floor and reading Bertrand Russell. So I knew what philosophy was, but I didn't know at that point that you could study at a university. I knew nothing about universities, and I was planning to do medicine anyway.
So philosophy had always interested you, but when it came to deciding what to study at university, you chose medicine.
I think I wanted to read medicine, partly my fascination with how the body works and so on and so forth, and I wanted to do psychiatry, not primarily because I wanted to cure people who had mental illness, but to understand, you know, what was going on so that somebody or other, perhaps me, perhaps somebody else, might one day be able to cure mental illness of various sorts. So I was always interested in that, and that's why I went into medicine.
But your big interest, your big passion was philosophy.
Well, yes, but I didn't know that, you see. I remember going up for interview at Cambridge, Newnham College, and they had these notices on the walls for the times of interviews, you know, and it would say, you know, natural sciences this, moral sciences such and such. And I said to somebody, well, you know, what's moral sciences? And they said, oh, that's philosophy. And I said, what? You mean you can study philosophy at university? You know, which I had never realised.
You were a star pupil at Cambridge and finished your three-year medical degree in just two. And I have to add, getting the highest marks in your final exams across all natural sciences at Cambridge. When you decided to make a temporary diversion from medicine into philosophy, I mean, that must have met considerable opposition. There you were, you know, a high achiever, full of promise, and yet you wanted to waste your time on philosophy.
Well, yes, that's what people thought. Yes, no, I mean, nobody wanted me to do it. But the thing is, because I suppose I'd done so well and so forth, I was in a strong position to say, look, I really want to do this. It's perfectly legal, you know, you can't say it isn't allowed. You can only advise me against it. And I choose not to take your advice.
When you decided on this temporary diversion from medicine into philosophy, you chose to study at an institution that was independent of the University of Cambridge, the Cambridge Language Research Unit. What sort of work was going on there?
Well, it was run by a woman called Margaret Masterman, and I wanted to be taught by her. That's why I wanted to go there. Very creative, very maverick, extraordinary woman. And she was one of the first people in the world to do research on machine translation. and that's what the unit was dedicated to, machine translation and information retrieval, but working on language and the structure of language. And she was one of the first people, perhaps the first person, to use a thesaurus instead of a dictionary to try and do translations, indeed to think about language in general. And the reason for that is, if you say to me, you know, where were you at 10 o'clock this morning, and I tell you I was at the bank, you actually can't be quite sure whether I mean I was getting money out of a financial institution or whether I was sitting among the buttercups by a flowing stream. Now, if I had said to you, 10 o'clock this morning, I was at the bank and I got my feet wet, well, then you would probably have realised it might. So rather than word-for-word dictionary definitions, she was looking at clusters of meaning in order to interpret one word in terms of the word surrounding it. And of course, actually, that is the basis now of all search engines, Google.
I mean, this is, you know, 60 years ago, isn't
it?
Yes. And that's where it all started.
Well, I started there in 57. I think they were founded in, I think it was 55 that they started, 54 or 55.
Well, Alan Turing, the founder of computer science, had died the year before, 1954, and the possibility of machine intelligence and the potential of computing to develop it was hotly debated at the time. How did this eclectic mix of scientists at the Cambridge Language Research Unit view the potential of the whole of artificial intelligence?
Oh, I think they agreed with Turing about they thought the potential was very great. In fact, they didn't really talk about it very much in terms of it being hotly debated because they thought it was so obviously true, you know, and they accepted that. And in fact, Margaret Masterman's husband was a man called Richard Braithwaite, and he had been a fellow of Turing's at King's, and he had been involved in some of Turing's early broadcast on the BBC about machine thinking, the expression used then. So I think people took it for granted that computers had a huge potential. And I think it's probably true to say they took it for granted that you could understand the things that the mind does, in principle, by using computational concepts.
This is the late 50s we're talking about. This is before electronic computers. You know, how do you develop ideas to do with artificial intelligence when you don't have a computer to test it on?
Well, they had a computer next door, so to speak. I mean, the really pioneering computer, the Cambridge computer, the ANZAC, which Maurice Wilkes had built, was, so to speak, round the corner in the computer lab. But they didn't have their own computer in the unit until, several years after I left.
So where did you, the young Maggie Bowden, fit into this thrilling mix? How did the ideas that were being worked on there feed into what you were interested in yourself?
Well, they didn't feed in as much as they should have done. I mean, I looking back, I kick myself for not having the wit to see that what they were saying about language and memory and so forth applied to the issues that interested me, namely mental illness, free choice, purpose, creativity, those sorts of issues, which is what I was primarily interested in. And I think the reason is that they weren't programming. They didn't have computers to program on, so they were thinking primarily about, if you like, the structure of language, so how concepts fit with each other and that sort of thing. They weren't explicitly concentrating on what actually goes on in the mind or the brain, whichever way you want to put it, when we use language. And I think that's why I didn't get the point immediately.
You were offered a job lecturing in philosophy at the University of Birmingham. How did you choose between medicine and philosophy?
I asked them for 48 hours to think about it because I genuinely wasn't sure whether I wanted it. And I suppose one of the reasons why I chose to take the job was that it was much more of a challenge. I wasn't at all sure that I could do it. More to the point, I knew that when I was 60, 65, you know, which in those days I thought of as being very old, I could look back on my life, and if I'd been a doctor, unless I'd been a complete butcher, which I wouldn't have been as a psychiatrist, I could think I'd done some good. But frankly, I think if you look back on your life as a professional philosopher at that age and you haven't been really good, then I think, you know, you probably haven't done very much. So it was a challenge. And I suppose that's partly why I took it.
So after a few years of lecturing in philosophy in this fairly traditional environment at the University of Birmingham. You became a Harkness Fellow at Harvard, and I know that you had a light bulb moment there, even before you started. What happened?
Yes. Well, I'd been in the other Cambridge, Cambridge, Massachusetts, maybe a couple of days, and I walked into a second-hand bookshop. And I picked up this book, and it literally changed my life in 5 minutes, because what it was a book called Plans and the Structure of Behaviour. And it was the first book which took the idea of programs, computer programs, and applied that idea to the whole of psychology. I mean, not just cognitive psychology, memory, language, problem solving, but also instinct, personality, hypnosis. Now, of course, this was very, very, very early days, and the book was necessarily very simplistic, very broadly sketched, but it was a book of vision. And I just saw immediately, literally in about 5 minutes leafing through it, I got the point, which I should have got when I was at CLRU, that programs give you a way of thinking about processes, what happens now, what happens next, what has to be the case in order for that to happen, etc., etc., etc. And it gives you a way of thinking about that in a very, very clear way. And the computer will tell you, if you manage to put it into a computer program and try and run it, the computer will tell you whether you actually can get the results that you expect from this program or not. And as I say, I kick myself for not having the wit to see at the time that you could do that.
Aaron Sloman, who is an honorary professor of artificial intelligence and cognitive science at the University of Birmingham, and who has known you since the early 1960s, credits you with remarkable prescience in recognizing when you did what artificial intelligence could offer.
She was one of the very few philosophers who understood that new developments in artificial intelligence were deeply important for philosophy, not just for making useful new machines, not just for perhaps helping neuroscientists or psychologists get new tools, but for addressing old philosophical problems about the nature of mind, the nature of consciousness, the nature of learning, the nature of perception, the nature of language, and so on. And she spotted that in the early 1960s. And that work went on through many books and papers, culminating, although not ending, in her 2006 magnum opus, a massive two-volume history of cognitive science, in which she documents a great deal of stuff that most people don't ever find out about, and they get things wrong as a result.
Well, thank you, Aaron. What can I say?
Well, I mean, the next few decades must have been hugely exciting in the artificial intelligence field. As computers become much more available, sophisticated computer modelling begins to take off. What did you think back then were the possibilities for modelling complex human thought?
I thought that, in principle, there were no limits in terms of using computational ideas and computers to model human minds. In principle, I think there are no barriers there, because to deny that, it seems to me, is to say that the human mind works by magic, or the human brain works by magic, and it certainly doesn't. Now, of course, I do not believe that the set of computational concepts we've got at the moment will turn out to be enough to do that. And very often, you know, when people criticise this sort of area, they look at today's computers, you know, whatever date today happens to be, and they sort of point a scornful finger and say, well, you know, they can't do it. Well, yeah, sure, they can't do it. But that would be rather like saying to Galileo, when Galileo said, you know, God's language in the world is mathematics, but like pointing a finger at Galileo and saying, well, your maths can't do this, and then you find some problem in physics that Galileo couldn't solve. Well, yes, but Galileo didn't mean I, Galileo, can solve every problem in physics. Just take my equations. What he meant was, I've solved some of them. And this approach, this way of thinking about physics, i.e. quantitative mathematical, is the way to do physics. And, of course, about that he was absolutely right. So, if you like, I'm saying something equivalent about computational concepts. Computational concepts of some form, including the ones that we've got now, but no doubt adding others too, those are the way to think clearly and rigorously about the mind and to understand how it's possible for there to be such an amazing thing as a human mind in a basically material universe and depending on a material system, namely the body and the brain.
But of course, you know, as you say, there was opposition too, wasn't there? You know, people, I guess, were just offended by the very idea of using robots to study humans. Were you at all sympathetic to the view that the human brain, a mind with mental states like perception, self-awareness, capable of complex emotions, could never be replicated by a computer program?
Well, personally, I don't think it ever will be, in practice. And I think a lot of rubbish is talked about AI by many people in AI and some people outside AI, people who talk, for example, about the singularity, the so-called singularity.
Well, this is when the computer becomes...
Yes,
conscious.
The computer, yeah, well, becomes more intelligent.
More intelligent than a human, yes.
And yes. I mean, I'd almost say I wish, except it's such a terrible prospect that, of course, I wouldn't say I wish. In other words, you know, the human mind is far and away the most complex system that we know about. And language in particular is hugely complex. And although it's true that we have got further in, for example, machine translation, which we talked about, than I think was expected, still, it's hugely limited what these things can do. And the notion of there ever being a time where we could have a natural language-using program which was able really to converse in a rich and subtle way with a intelligent and educated human being about anything under the sun, from, you know, football to fossils, seems to me to be a fantasy. It's not that it's in principle impossible. And it's not that we won't learn a great deal, as well as getting some useful gizmos, if we try. But the notion that we will ever actually be able to do this, well, personally, I wouldn't be at all surprised if we never can, and we most certainly are not going to be able to do it, you know, within a few decades, which is what the singularity merchants believe.
Looking back, it's probably not at all surprising that after Harvard, you joined the University of Sussex, an institution that pioneered multidisciplinary working, and eventually you helped found the School of Cognitive and Computer Sciences there. Now, a young student in the late 70s was Blay Whitby, a philosopher and expert in the social implications of artificial intelligence.
What's really interesting about cognitive science and Maggie's role in it is that to create this science of mind, we need to study, at the very least, neuroscience, psychology, or psychology of the right sort of rigour, cognitive linguistics, philosophy, computer science and artificial intelligence. And all those disciplines need to be integrated. You can't answer the scientific questions about mind just considering any one of these. And of course, Maggie has not only reported on this new discipline of cognitive science, she's been instrumental in creating it. She was there at many of the most important moments. And what's, I think, unique about Maggie is that she's a philosopher who has informed, inspired, and shaped science. And it's important that I emphasise that because many modern scientists say that philosophers have got nothing to tell them, and they'd be advised to look at the work and life of Maggie Bowden before making that claim.
Do you accept the description that you're one of the architects of the discipline of cognitive science, or the science of the mind?
Well, yes, I suppose so. I mean, because of my very strange educational background. I studied medicine, philosophy and psychology in my PhD at Harvard independently, and then discovered AI. And because I've had that very unusual background, I'm able to read and understand the language in all of these areas and put them together. So, yes, I'm a very strange interdisciplinary beast. But what I've tried to do, and the reason why I wrote that huge book, was to encourage people, now that everyone's getting much more specialised, and of course more's being found out, and the disciplines are hiving, and sub-disciplines and sub-sub-disciplines are hiving off, trying to get people to realise how their stuff relates to one another. Because I don't think you can understand the human mind unless you look at it from all those points of view. So I try and fit it all together.
Now, Maggie, you also believe that creativity and the philosophical concepts that underpin creativity could be studied scientifically. And many people credit you with having turned the study of creativity into a respectable academic field. Ernest Edmonds, who's an artist and professor of computational art at De Montfort University in Leicester, thinks he knows why you picked this area to explore.
Maggie has ended up being very interested in creativity because she's very interested in hard problems. She wants to be challenged and she wants to tackle things that are difficult. And creativity, human creativity, is perhaps one of the most difficult aspects of human life. I could quote a number of academics who've said to me things like, it's too hard, don't bother with it. And that's exactly the sort of thing that makes Maggie interested in it.
Well, actually, that's true. I do try and take the hard problems. And with respect to creativity, years ago when I wrote what was in effect, I mean, perhaps the first or one of the two first books on artificial intelligence, one of the chapter headings was creativity. And all of my AI friends said, what? But there isn't any work on creativity. And I said, well, A, there should be. Because if you think, which they all did think, if you think that AI, you know, is the way to think about the human mind, you've got to face creativity, because it's a hugely important aspect of the human mind. So, A, there should be, and B, actually there is, only it's not called that. So, again, it was something that I was always interested in, and I never believed that it was sort of divine intervention or magic. It must have some sort of scientific explanation, but the question is, how can you get it?
Well, how can computational ideas help us to understand what creativity is and how it happens?
Because they can help us to understand the sorts of psychological processes that are possible, can help us to understand how novel combinations of ideas happen. But of course, that's a very, very old idea. It's several hundred years old. But that isn't the only way that creativity happens. It also happens by taking a style of thinking, whether it's a way of doing chemistry or whether it's a way of doing painting, and coming up with new structures in that style. So a new impressionist painting, for example, or a new chemical molecule in a particular area of chemistry, for example, what I call exploratory creativity. And actually, I would say that maybe 95% of what professional artists and scientists do is either exploratory creativity or combinational creativity. And the other 5% is what I call transformational creativity, where the rules, if you like, of the style that were being used to explore the style, one or more of those rules is being dropped, altered, changed in some way, so that now novel structures become possible which were impossible before. And the point about computer science is that it's helped us to understand, you know, what a generative system is, you know, how it's possible to have a set of rules, which may be a very, very short, you know, briefly statable set of rules, but which has the potential to generate infinitely many different structures. And that's absolutely everyday idea in computer science. It isn't just an idea, it's a reality. You can actually do it. And so if you're a computer artist, for example, I mean, certain sorts of computer artists, they take advantage of that generative capacity of the computer. Of course, they specify the rules, and they generate, or rather the computer generates under their initial inspiration, vision, I won't say direction, because the computer is doing it by itself in many cases, it generates structures which they couldn't have generated unaided, and which they couldn't even have imagined. But the point about the computer is not so much the computer, it's the computational concepts that help us to understand how it's possible for someone to come up with a new idea. Because at first sight, it just seems completely impossible. God must have done it.
Maggie Roden, There have been grand predictions made within artificial intelligence over the decades about how computers will advance and become ever more powerful until they'll ultimately become conscious and self-aware. After more than half a century working in this field, what would you say are the limits of these tin cans, I believe? Aaron Sloman, who we heard from earlier, says you refer to computers as tin cans.
Yes.
What are their limits? I gather from that rather derogatory remark, I can guess what you're going to say about their limits.
Well, you see, I don't think there are any limits in principle. Or at least, if there are, we have no idea what they are or might be because we don't have a good idea what consciousness is, right? But if you take any human performance, anything which we can do, and just put the question of consciousness on one side for the moment, I certainly don't think there's anything in principle which would prevent an artificial computational system doing that, because to deny that is to say that it happens by magic, and I don't believe that it happens by magic. But that isn't to say that we'll ever actually be able to do it. It's true that computers are getting more and more powerful, more and more quickly, and so on. That is absolutely true, of course. And that's partly why there are things that we can do in AI today which would be mere fantasy 20 years ago, never mind 50 years ago. But computer power isn't enough. You've also got to have powerful ideas. In other words, ideas about what the psychological processes are, and if you want to think of it in terms of the brain, ideas about what the neural processes are. But these ideas have to be computation. You know, what computations is it that the brain is performing? What is the brain doing in that sense? But these things are very, very difficult, and I see no reason to assume that we will, one of these days, be able to answer all of those questions. Maybe we will, maybe we won't.
Professor Maggie Bowden, thank you for letting me hear your Life Scientific.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.